Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, September 20th, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. We're very pleased to welcome, we anticipate three experts on our calls, but so far we have but two on the call. Our call is going to be moderated by Vincent J. Vitkowski. He's a partner at Seiger, Gefeller, Lurie in New York. As I mentioned, he's going to moderate, and I'm going to leave it to him to introduce the two panelists momentarily. But just a note to our audience, as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please have those in mind for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Vince Vitkowski, the floor is yours.
Thank you. We have John Yu so far. I'm waiting for Jeremy, so I'll introduce John first. John joined the faculty of Berkeley in 1993. He's clerked for Justice Thomas at the Supreme Court, Judge Silberman at the D.C. Circuit. He was general counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee and served in the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department following during and following 9/11. So he has all three branches of government covered. He's received the Federal Society's Bader Award for Excellence in Legal Scholarship and Teaching and is a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Jeremy Rapkin has been a professor of law at Scalia Law School, George Mason's, since 2007, and before that, for over 20 years, he was a professor of government at Cornell University. Jeremy is on the board of directors of the U.S. Institute of Peace, the Board of Academic Advisors of the American Enterprise Institute, and the Board of Directors of the Center for Individual Rights. Both Jeremy and John are prolific authors and commentators. John is actually, I'd say, hyper-prolific. Their latest work is the collaboration we're talking about today, Striking Power. And it's a compelling and provocative book, which will be, I, in my view, embraced by policymakers, but criticized by the legal academy, because it argues that the contemporary understanding of the law of war will need to come to accept attacks by these new weapons directed at civilian objects. So let's see how they get there. John, one of the many fascinating parts of the book is the discussion of the historic resistance to new weapons technology. You refer to efforts to ban the crossbow in Europe in the 12th century because it upset the balance of power, the strategic balance favoring knights. And then you take it forward. Could you elaborate, move us up through developments over time in this area?
Vince, thanks a lot for agreeing to host this, and I'm really grateful that you've taken the care to read the book and come forward with these perceptive questions. And I'd like to thank Dean and the Federal Society for inviting me, and soon I hope Jeremy will be joining us, and for everyone who's listening, for joining the call. So I think this was one of the most fascinating parts of the research that we did, was uncovering and bringing forward, at least to the legal audience, the way that technology and weapons and then legal regimes have all been connected over time. And as you just said, Vince, there have been previous revolutions in military technology, and our argument is that the laws of war have always been slow to adapt, and that there are always people, always countries that try to ban any new kind of new technologies, usually unsuccessfully. So one a great example that you brought up, Vince, is the crossbow. The crossbow basically meant that any lightly trained peasant could shoot and kill an armored knight at a great distance. And this broke the monopoly on force that was held by knights who were all aristocrats and required a great deal of resources and training in order to be skilled at this kind of face-to-face combat with swords. It's very interesting. The Catholic Church tried to ban the crossbow. Various kings, even Holy Roman emperors, tried to ban the crossbow because they thought it was immoral or unethical to shoot and kill someone over a distance. Some thought it was ignoble to allow peasants as a class to try to counteract or kill knights. But even in more modern times, we have better examples. I think of course, before the information technology revolution we're living through today, the big economic revolution was the Industrial Revolution and mass production that followed. And the wars that we saw in the 20th century were a direct result of that economic revolution. The weapons we saw in World War I and then in World War II were the harnessing of these domestic economic technology developments to war. Consider the submarine, consider airplane, long-range artillery, large draft armies with cheap mass-produced weapons like the machine gun and later the long-range rifle and so on. A lot of these weapons were the subject of efforts at bans. So think about there were efforts to ban the submarine, famously, in World War I. There were efforts to ban aerial combat and bombing. Our argument in the book is that a lot of these are doomed to failure. Most of them fail because, first, it's very hard to stop the application of technology to war. But second, a lot of these bans, people try to get them into place early on, before we know much about the consequences of these weapons, before we know who's going to win and who's going to lose. They have, you know, the fancy terms, they have asymmetric effects. Some countries do better, some countries do worse. And the countries that do better are not going to be interested in following any kind of ban. And so we predict that the time that you're going to see these kinds of successful efforts is more when you've had the time, experience, you understand the effect of these new kinds of weapons, and the countries involved that agree basically are some level of kind of parity. So by giving up or banning these weapons, no one's relative positions are going to be changed. No one's going to be really helped and no one's going to be really hurt.
Looking back historically, you have some marvelous chapter titles in the book. I'll comment. One of the chapters is called "A Few Things Regarded as Barbarous and Cruel: The Law of War Before the 1970s." Can you tell us about some of those things?
Yeah, thanks. This was also another, I think, interesting part, I hope, of our book that makes it appealing. Is if the first part was about historical change, economic change, and then the effect on war. The second part or theme of the book is the history of the laws of war. And I think a lot of people don't realize for most of human history, there were no written down laws of war. They were more like customs and practices. And there was a lot of deference given to the judgment of military commanders based on necessity, what was necessary for them to achieve their military goals. I mean, the primary restraint being a humanity towards combatants and trying to avoid, to the extent possible, harming civilians. On the other hand, you know, as we show, even in the context of the Civil War, which was when we saw the very first written code of the laws of war issued by President Lincoln. It's called General Order Number 100. He actually had a Columbia law professor named Lieber draft up a code that was given as an order to the Union armies. Even in the context of that effort to regulate warfare, we still saw very hard tactics used by the Union armies. Most famously and controversially, Sherman's march through the South, the alleged burning of parts of Atlanta. These were justified as necessary to win the war, to destroy the productive capacity of the South. And then we saw World War I, of course, large casualties on the battlefields. Again, there was a lot of deference given to the military commanders to be reasonable, to try to attach what they were doing in a reasonable way to their military goals, but not to try to enact a legal code, you know, like the IRS, the Revenue Code, or one of the regulations we see our administrative state issuing all the time. Instead, there were basic principles of proportionality, distinction, and necessity that governed the use of force, and weren't bound down by strict rules. And I think that's one of the things we try to show here is that, you know, there were things that later on commentators were saying, oh, that was barbarous, that was cruel, but sometimes they had the effect of bringing the war to a close faster or sometimes the effect of pressuring civilian economies. The one example we bring forward in this area of the book is, for example, sometimes the United States and other Western countries would engage what they called, quote-unquote, Pacific reprisals, where they might use force against a smaller country to get them to pay their debts, for example. Or they would, most famously, sometimes the United States would take over the customs in a port in Latin America in order to get it to pay its debts so that a European country wouldn't intervene. So one point we tried to make here is that there was a lot more coercion going on between states using force that was seen as legal, that wasn't a full-blown war of the kind that we would see in a World War I and a World War II, and that the laws of war, international law at that time, made allowance for this. It didn't try to excessively regulate any of these activities because it was seen that this should really rest in the reasonable judgment of commanders and the political leadership.
There was several striking quotes in your book on this subject. You quote Civil War General Philip Sheridan, who in his memoir said that reduction to poverty brings prayers for peace more surely and more quickly than does the destruction of human life. But that was interesting. I also you know that back in World War II, to take it to the more large scale examples, the editorials in the New York Times defended the firebombings of Hamburg and Dresden when they occurred in real time. But then the law of war started to take on a new cast. Another chapter of yours is entitled "How the War of Law was Hijacked." So what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that there's a big change in the laws of war that occurs in the 1970s and culminates in what are called the additional protocols to the Geneva Conventions. When we commonly talk about the Geneva Conventions, today we're referring to the Geneva Conventions written right after World War II in 1949, and then there were earlier Geneva Conventions in 1929. And these are written after the wars have ended, and they aren't really trying to regulate that tightly the use of force on the battlefield. They're mostly about the treatment of the sick and the wounded or at sea or as prisoners or their trial. In the 1970s, that changed. In the 1970s, there's a sharp break, and now we see these additions, these amendments to the Geneva Conventions seek to regulate how war is actually fought. And we argue that it's not just that they extended to this area, but that the effort to write these rules becomes the forum for ideological combat, and that it's these rules become very much the product of a third world sort of decolonial agenda, in some cases inspired by Marxist ideology. So, for example, and this is the main reason the United States in the end did not ratify the major additional protocol to the Geneva Conventions, even though our European allies now all have, was because, as a product of this ideological movement, it sought to give protections, the same status to guerrillas and insurgents that are provided to regular soldiers. So even though insurgents and guerrillas don't wear uniforms, they don't act in regular units, they often are blending into the civilian population, the 1977 amendments basically clothe them in the same status that Western soldiers, that U.S. soldiers do, even though they identify themselves clearly, they operate in regular armed units, they operate according to rules of discipline. And so what we try to show is that the laws of war, as many people talk about it today, even though some may not even be aware of these roots, but it's very much a product of this kind of post-World War II decolonization effort, where we think that a lot of the drafting of the traditional protocols was hijacked in an effort to give an advantage to those kinds of forces and in a way hamstring Western forces. So this is where you start to see these very tight, these efforts to tightly regulate the use of force, to try to, where you see efforts to demarcate places where the use of force can't go, even if it seems that the guerrillas or insurgents are deliberately inviting attacks. This is where you start to see efforts to write into law a rule of proportionality that makes it very hard for Western forces to use new technology, and really gives the advantage to those who were fighting back in those days that were called Third World Liberation. I don't remember that, Vince. These Third World Liberation fronts, right, that they were everywhere. These laws of wars really tried to rebalance the rules to favor them and to restrict Western powers, which are much more dependent on technology and firepower and discipline, rather than the kind of irregular fighting that we started to see in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Now, with respect to the new weapons, you do make the point that there have been efforts to proclaim codifications of law, especially in cyber, that simply don't exist. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
It's a great point, Vince. I think what happens now, today, we have these new weapons now, and these new weapons are really the product of the same transformations we're seeing in the civilian economy. So if you see all this rapid development in robotics and autonomous cars, you're going to see the same developments with military weapons. The drone, aerial drone, is just the first example, the leading edge of what we're going to start seeing. Cyber as well. So we're seeing enormous gains and advances in the internet and communications and data processing, and you're going to see exactly the same thing go on with military affairs, with cyber. We now cyber is, in addition to air, land, and sea, and space, cyber is considered a new dimension for combat. The thing that cyber offers that really runs against this project, this ideological project about the laws of war, is that cyber allows us to inflict harm on rivals, enemies, either in war or in this area below war of low-intensity coercion and competition, but in a way that doesn't kill anybody. But that might cause us to target what the additional protocols would say are purely civilian infrastructure that should be protected. So here's an example. Two examples. One is economic sanctions. So the international law and the UN Charter and most diplomats, even people speaking today about President Trump's speech, are all saying, well, we're all trying diplomacy first. We're trying economic sanctions before we ever get to the use of force. What are economic sanctions? Economic sanctions are essentially harming the economy and a civilian population and trying to get them to, because of this harm, get the leadership of their country to change course. Perfectly legal, even desirable. What about if we use cyber weapons to achieve the same goal? Cyber weapons allow us, for example, to temporarily shut down the Moscow Stock Exchange for a day, or cyber weapons could allow us to shut down the electrical grid in Belgrade, which, incidentally, we did with bombs during the Kosovo War. Or it could allow us to freeze out part of the Iranian regime or the North Korean regime from the banking system, or interfere with a variety of other things. A lot of people criticize these kinds of ideas because they are attacking what appears to be civilian infrastructure and not military targets, as prohibited by these additional protocols and the laws that have come since. But to us, that seems preferable. Cyber allows us to more precisely target and to more precisely pressure our opponents, but in ways that don't kill anybody. In fact, in ways that can be temporary, that we could paralyze a financial system in another country, but not permanently destroy it and lift it after a day or two. That seems to be much more preferable to the ultimate goal of the laws of war, to reduce harm and reduce casualties. But they say because of the, one last thing, I think that's typical of all of the technological revolutions that we're seeing today that are coming over from the economy to warfare, and that we've seen just the earliest glimmerings of in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other places is that unlike the technological change of the last century and how it affected war, you know, war became more harmful, more destructive, armies became bigger, and the harm ran mostly, you know, the millions killed, a lot of them were civilians. Today, most wars, I think 90% of the casualties of are civilians in wars today. These kind of weapons, understand there's a transformation. These weapons are more precise, less damaging, because of the information that we're able to collect and process, and that allows for much better targeting with less damage to civilians or surrounding structures. So I don't see why, you know, the laws of war, if you think about it, actually try to push us, the laws of war as they were in the 1970s and since, try to push us into using the more harmful, more destructive means of fighting war, whereas cyber would allow us to try to squeeze or stop a nuclear program in Iran or North Korea, or at least put pressure on rivals and enemy countries to get them to change course. So hopefully we never go to any kind of full-blown conventional war. And I think that should be the real goal of the laws of war.
So you've begun to apply the background specifically to robotics and cyber and space weapons. Why don't I just ask you to elaborate on the ways in which other weapons could achieve your goal, which is to end a conflict with as little death and destruction as possible.
Yes, interesting. So robotics are the things I think that we see seem most obvious. And here I blame James Cameron because he made so many good movies involving, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger as a robotic warrior who hunts down human beings, but then eventually changes sides. That's not necessarily the kind of robots we're going to see, you know, the kind walking around that look just like human beings with guns. Consider the first UAVs we've seen, the Predator and the Reaper and these kinds of drones. They are a lot cheaper than a manned aircraft. I think for the price of one F-35, you can buy about 25 or even 30 of these unmanned drones. That trend is going to continue. Drones are going to get cheaper and cheaper. They're also going to get smaller and smaller. And they're going to spread from the air, where it's just easiest to deploy them because there's a lot more space. There's a lot less, you know, possibility of collision, and you're going to see them used on the ground, ground vehicles. You're going to see them used at sea. I think you're going to see a lot of development at sea where you could replace a lot of crew functions, and you could start deploying them submarines and difficult to go places. So you're also going to see them operate. The other change you're going to see the more in this trend is you're going to see them robots act in smaller units, but as groups, as swarms, and you'll see lots of small robots, say air UAVs, try to crash into a single target, rather than, as we see today, sort of really operating like a remote-controlled aircraft that just doesn't have the pilot in the seat. The pilot's just remote-controlling it back in. It happens to be near Las Vegas, Nevada, of all places. So what does that mean? That means, again, robotic weapons are going to take combatants off the field, right? You know, you're going to have less risk of life on the part of Americans, and you're also going to see, because of the smaller drones, they have smaller warheads, they're going to be more precise, and you see more precise targeting. Also, you're going to have robots that can take the place of human soldiers for the worst, most difficult, most dangerous missions. So you'll see robots that are responsible for removing IEDs, or that are responsible for breaching houses, or that are able to travel undersea at greater depth, or go into the most dangerous situations, because we don't have to worry about getting the human pilot or the human sailors back. What you'll see with robotics then is you should see a reduction in harm to combatants, certainly. But also, I think, because of the precision that they offer, right, the ability to circle on station in the air for days or weeks at an end and fire at targets when they are farthest away from civilians or have the lowest yield of damage around the targets. So I think you'll see also a decline in the harm and destruction of war as affects other countries and their societies and their civilian populations too. And again, our point is, why would we want to ban that? You know, we've seen, particularly in this area, in robotic weapons and artificial intelligence, you've seen Elon Musk just 2 weeks ago signed a letter with 100 tech CEOs calling for an outright ban. Two or three years ago, 1,000 AI scientists also joined Musk and Steve Wozniak from Apple and Stephen Hawking, the great British scientist, also calling for a ban on these technologies. Our argument is that actually the use of these robots should make, again, war more precise, less destructive. Hopefully it also have the broader effect of reducing the possibilities of some kind of crisis between great powers growing into a bigger conflagration of a more general war, because you won't have as many as much national pride. You won't have men and women's lives at stake in combat. It hopefully gives more space to countries to come to a negotiated solution where they're not risking the men and women in uniform and then they're not putting their national honor at stake, which may lead to an unintentional escalation. So hopefully our bigger pitch is these kinds of weapons like cyber and robotics might even lead to less war overall.
One of the flashpoints for the anti-robotics critics is autonomous robotic weaponry, when the decision to fire is made by an algorithm rather than a human being. I mean, how close are we to that, and how would that affect your analysis?
It's a great question, Vince. It's a difficult question. One thing to keep in mind is that I think we've already crossed that line in some ways. Think about a mind. Something as primitive, simple as a mind is already autonomous in a sense. You know, it has certain conditions. If they're met, it explodes. We have cruise missiles that are already making certain kinds of decisions about paths and what targets to strike based on the defenses. Also, in the area of missile defense, we rely a great deal on autonomous automatic responses, particularly systems that are guarding naval vessels. And we're going to see more of that because just warfare is becoming so quick and there's so many variables involved that the machines can respond faster or more accurately than human beings. But as you say, as you suggest, the next step will be to allow more and more autonomy on the part of weapons, where the weapons make the target selections once they're deployed on the battlefield, or in defensive posture, they're used to patrol a border and they're given a certain categories, algorithms, categories of targets to attack. Certainly at the DMZ in along Korea, you would probably have border sentries automated. They're already, Samsung makes one that would be designed to shoot almost anything that comes across the border, because almost anything coming across the DMZ would be presumed to be hostile. Maybe you have an exception for obvious civilians, but you know, so one thing is, it's got to be a comparative question. You know, no one can claim, you know, the machines are going to be perfect. You know, human beings make the machines, human beings program the machines. There are going to be errors. The comparative question is really, are they going to reduce mistakes? Are autonomous weapon systems going to reduce the errors, just as they are in civilian life? If you look at the data about the Google autonomous car, apparently it's driven about 500,000 miles with only one accident. That's an incredible safety record. You know, obviously, it would be better if it was zero accidents. That may not be possible, but even just one accident is way below average human drivers. If you had most people driving Google cars, the accident rate would drop. We lose over 35,000 people to traffic fatalities in the United States every year. If we could get that number to drop significantly, that's still much better than the old days when everyone's just driving their car on their own without any assistance. I think it's the same question we should bring to bear with these autonomous weapons. Are they reducing the rate of harm and errors compared to more direct human control or human soldiers on the battlefield? The second, I think, response to your point, Vince, is that it's not that as if the machines will just take over and act as they like. I think it's still always the case that the autonomous weapons are still going to be launched. They're still going to be made, programmed, and launched by human beings. And they're still the ones responsible for the goals of war and the means we use to fight them. And this is where I think we get into the realm of science fiction. I think there is this kind of fear. It's not really legal or political. It's almost really cultural, where people just have this idea that the robots will somehow seize control and take over. It's actually, if you think about it, an odd way of anthropomorphizing. You know, we're sort of imputing motives on the part of the very robots that we program and design and give them sort of the human motivation to take over, when actually we're designing this for much more limited roles. So, of course, there's always this possibility it might happen, but there's no evidence other than the realm of science fiction that this has ever happened or will happen. And instead, I think because of that fear, we're giving up these really concrete gains in more certainty, more precision, and less destruction from these kinds of weapons.
If you're ready to go really out there, how about outer space?
way out there. Space is interesting because a lot of people, when they think about these changes in technology and warfare, they think about cyber, they think maybe about robots. They really kind of overlook space, and we wanted to bring attention to that because there's also a revolution going on in space too, as we see with these pictures of SpaceX. Also, Elon Musk's company, SpaceX, even though he's calling for a ban on weapons, he's certainly pushing forward a revolution, not just with electric cars, but with outer space. In the last 10 years, because of competition, private competition, and a lighter regulatory hand, the launch costs in the last 10 years to put a satellite in space have fallen by 90%. It's incredible. And so you're in the civilian economy, you're seeing now plans for different networks, not to deploy a few dozen like the GPS system or some of the internet or cable TV systems, but you're talking about companies deploying networks of thousands of little satellites to provide internet service and so on. Similar transformation is going to happen. It is happening right now with military uses of space. And this is actually where you also see this kind of 1970s mindset. There are other countries. There's actually the European Union, and there are plenty of scholars who are calling for a demilitarization of space, trying to create a rules of the road to make space peaceful. Again, based on our earlier analysis of past efforts, we think this is going to be a failure. Already the Chinese in 2007, although they up until this point they were pressing for also a similar ban, then they went ahead and tested an anti-satellite missile system, and we tested one the year after. And so I think instead what's happening is you're going to see space used even more so than it's already. It's a kind of the backbone for the kind of high-precision, up-tempo military operations that we've seen with such great success in the Persian Gulf War and then the invasion of Iraq. The speed and quickness, low casualties and rapid victories have a lot to do with the communications and sensors and support provided by U.S. Satellite systems, where we have a great superiority. But now we can use these missiles, space platforms to do even more things. I think that what you're going to see initially is their efforts to use space to build a better missile defense system. Look at the threat of North Korea, which is on everyone's minds right now. Our missile defense system is designed to shoot missiles right now at the hardest point, which is when they're plunging from the atmosphere to the target, when they're at their highest velocity. It's called, unfortunately, the terminal phase of a ballistic missile's path. And that really is like trying to shoot a bullet with a bullet. It's amazing that we hit any of these targets with the defense system, the very small defense system we've got in Alaska. The best time to strike a North Korean missile is on the launch pad when it's just struggling to take off, which is called the boost phase. It's very easy to detect because there's a huge plume of fire that comes out of the missile. The missile's moving slowly. It's very vulnerable. It can't deploy decoys. That's the best time to strike. Probably the best place to strike the missile from is space. You can detect it quickly. Gravity is on your side. I think that's where we'll see advancement. Now, in the short and medium term, what we should also be doing is deploying the existing missile technologies we have, anti-missile technologies we have, to, say, deploy anti-missile ships around North Korea, deploy drones above the airspace that could be designed to shoot at missiles on the launch pad. But ultimately, the best vantage point, the high ground, is going to be in space. And that's where you should see even more rapid development as we try to respond to North Korea and maybe other rogue nations like Iran in the future. And I think there, in order to do that, the United States and has got to put aside these claims from Europeans and academics and government, UN international officials, that we've got to demilitarize space, because I think that's also part of the 1970s effort to hijack the laws of war to, in a way, counterbalance the West's advantage in technology.
You mentioned in the book a space weapon that I just thought was fascinating, and it's really a gravity-based weapon. What did you call them? The tungsten rods?
Yeah, so the Air Force calls it the rods from God. it's a system where the Air Force has proposed this weapon system where, and it's still in the research fit and development phase, where a satellite would just have tungsten rods, no warhead, no nuclear warhead or conventional warhead, and they would just be released onto targets. They could be guided with great precision because you would still have a guidance system on it, but just the speed of gravity, the velocity at which this would hit the Earth with no warhead would be similar to a small tactical nuclear weapon, but with no radiation, no fallout, none of the sort of collateral costs. So a weapon like this would be ideal for striking at, you know, underground nuclear weapon depots, facilities, and bunkers, and that's a great example of some of the advantages that you have with space because you have the high ground. Now, of course, all these weapon systems, as I think you suggested, also come with vulnerabilities. The more we rely on space, the more we become vulnerable to anti-satellite weapons. The more we rely on cyber, the more we're plugged into the internet, the more we're vulnerable to hacking. The more we rely on autonomous robots, the more those could be hacked or interfered with electronically. And so, of course, we're going to have to take measures to try to safeguard any new kinds of space weapons from anti-satellite tech. Also, another thing to keep in mind is, I think this is also where people who are demanding a ban are being short-sighted, is that our rivals are not going to obey any ban. In fact, China and Russia, they think these technologies, they're pressing ahead very fast in these technologies. Even though the U.S. still has a great advantage, they're rapidly investing in these because they think they hope it can lead to a leapfrogging of the United States, that they could, the United States has huge conventional weapon superiority right now. But the Chinese and Russians hope to counteract that superiority by turning their efforts to these new kinds of weapons. So even if people in support of a ban could convince the United States, convince people in the West to do so, I don't think it's going to work. Take a look at the last 2 or 3 years. I think that's essentially what the Obama administration was trying to do with cyber. There are public accounts now how President Obama and his top advisors refused to use any kind of cyber weapons to retaliate against Russian interference in the elections. Whether it was successful or not, the Russians certainly tried, or to retaliate against the Chinese for stealing the entire government personnel database and who knows what else they've been doing. But under the Obama administration, there was this hope, a very utopian hope, that if we restrained ourselves and identified rules of the road not to use these weapons, Russia and China might go along. But as we've seen the last few years, they didn't go along. They took advantage of us. And so I'm afraid the only way to get them to restrain themselves is through deterrence. We unfortunately have to be able to retaliate, which, mind you, is also a violation of the 1970s version of international law and the UN Charter, is the idea of retaliation. You're only allowed to use force in self-defense, but what if you need to use it as a deterrent? And I think these kinds of weapons are actually well suited to that in a time when offensive weapons like cyber or robotics, offense is cheap, and when defense, like in cyber, is very expensive and hard, then you have to rely on deterrence rather than treaties of a ban in order to get the other side to restrain itself.
We're going to open in a few minutes the lines to listeners with questions. I'm going to just start with sort of two related questions, John, and ask you to comment on them. First, it seems to me that you at times overestimate the degree of precision of cyber weapons. You know, there's a phrase for when a virus goes outside its intended target and goes elsewhere. It's called into the wild. So it migrates from one machine to another around the world. In fact, there have been a lot of different angles for arguing that the law of war should not apply to cyber. One of them is that it just doesn't fit at all because you cannot apply the principles of distinction and proportionality because you can't control what happens to the virus once you let it go. That's sort of one collateral damage aspect. And then a related one, in the book today you suggested targeted attacks on power grids. And I know you know this, you underestimate the sort of the physical consequences of that. I mean, dark traffic lights are going to cause accidents. EMT workers are not going to, you know, get there in time to save lives. Hospitals, patients will be at risk as they run out of fuel in their emergency generators, you know, as they've done in the recent hurricanes. People are going to have fist fights over food. So the human costs of a neat cyber exploit can be hard to accurately predict. So how would you respond to those thoughts?
And they're both very good questions, and they emphasize a point which we shouldn't deny, which is right that these weapons it is still war. So we should claim that there's an antiseptic way to fight war. You know, of course, war is about inflicting harm on another country until it changes its policies. And so you're quite right to, you know, to argue against any kind of suggestion. And I don't mean to. I shouldn't get so excited that I might claim that or overemphasize the clinical precision of these kinds of weapons so much so that we ignore that the main point of it is still to impose costs. Our point that we're just trying to make in a book more modestly is compared to what? So you're right, Vince. You know, if you shut down the electrical grid, say in a Belgrade, as we did, you shut down the Belgrade, you're going to impose a lot of suffering, potentially deaths from accidents, from shutdowns of hospitals or essential facilities. Our only point is, if you recall, by the way, in the Kosovo air war, we dropped graphite bombs on the electoral systems, and instead we engage in these legal gymnastics to claim, well, some of the electricity gets to the Serbian military. We bombed a tractor factory because we said, oh, the parts also could go to the military. Or we bombed in Persian Gulf War, Iraq War, and the Serbian air war. We bombed highways, railroads, transportation facilities because we said, well, and we tried to bring down broadcast networks because we said, well, you know, some small part of that could benefit the military. Military drives on the roads. They use the water systems. They're using electricity. They use the communications. Or even, you know, they use the propaganda to keep support for the military. So I think those are getting so tenuous when what we're really doing is already what we're arguing for, which is trying to pressure the enemy using economic costs to change their course. It's really just the theory of economic sanctions, but we're, I think, being more honest and upfront about it. But you're quite right, Vince. We shouldn't pretend that it doesn't increase the cost. It doesn't harm people in enemy country. That's what they're designed to do. What we just want to do is to say, well, that's a better way of doing it than dropping bombs, destroying and killing people using conventional weapons. Your second point about is a sort of unintended consequences point. What happens if we release these weapons and they mutate or they spread beyond? So for Stuxnet is an example. I think you have that in mind. Stuxnet came apparent to people because it's spread from the Iranian systems to similar machines that were being used by other countries, the same industrial machines or the same software control programs for industrial machines were affected. So one thing is, we argue that the virus metaphor is a little misleading because it does make it seem like, oh, you use these cyber weapons and they're like biological weapons. They can mutate and spread and cause huge epidemics. And what we try to make is the cyber weapons to be most effective. First, they're usually built by states. They require a lot of resources. And to be most effective, they really have to be targeted. The more sort of general you make them, the more like these sort of global attacks on the internet or on financial systems aren't as effective and generally aren't the product of state-sponsored weapons research and use because they're too general, they're too obvious. And so we actually tend to discount the possibility. That's not to discount that there's threat from hacking and that there are instabilities in the internet, but we tend to think that nation states are not using as weapons, those kinds of attacks. That it's more like a Stuxnet than a kind of ransomware, a general attack on a fault in, say, Microsoft Windows.
In your, there's a nice summary of what you were trying to do. I thought that the single sentence I liked is that your purpose in this is to reclaim space for debate and deliberation, rather than allow restrictive views about the law of war to foreclose opportunities offered by the new technologies. So with that, I think, Dean, can we open the lines to questions?
Sure thing, Vince. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on the telephone. We'll wait a few seconds here and see if anybody rings in. Push the star button, then the pound button. Our lines are wide open.
Dean, what happens if I do that? I want to ask Vince a whole bunch of questions.
I don't think you need to push the button.
I bet no one's ever tried that.
you can just speak up. I do. While we're waiting to see if anybody in the audience rings in, I do have a question that I would ask. And again, if you're in the audience, push star and then the pound button. And it's about, I don't know if this you'd count this as proportionality or the ease of attack or the relative costs, the low cost of an attack versus the high cost of defense. Is that one of the things that animates a lot of a lot of the arguments on the other side, that these cyber attacks are so relatively easy to perpetrate, can be done by state actors and non-state actors, and the defense is so broad, it's almost impossible to defend against, and it requires more and more investment of time and treasure to defend yourself from these sorts of attacks.
And that's a good question, and that's the approach we're trying to bring to it is that, particularly with cyber, offense is cheap, relatively easy. Defense is very expensive and hard, as we're discovering right now with this hack on Equifax, for example. When that happens, you could go one of two ways. You could, if defense is so expensive and takes a long time, and it's just going to be so easy for the attackers to keep going the offensive, then you could do one of two things. You can try to, and I think this is a response of European countries and a response of UN officials, and approach of someone like Elon Musk, I think, is to seek a ban, try to regulate by law. And as our book argues, we're very dubious that can happen early on when the technologies are just appearing, because it doesn't affect everybody equally. And then the second way you could go, and I think this is really what does have to happen with I think the Obama administration tried that by restraining itself from responding with cyber weapons for many years, even though we have, I think, great superiority in the field. They were hoping other countries would cooperate with a ban. So the second thing, I think, is you have to rely on deterrence. And we have experience with this. A good example are nuclear weapons, ICBMs with nuclear weapons. If you think about it, in the Cold War period, it's very cheap to build lots and lots of nuclear weapons. I think in the United States, we had at some point 25,000 nuclear warheads at the heights of the Cold War. We had thousands and thousands of missiles and missile delivery systems. Very easy to keep building those. missile defense. It's very expensive, hard, and low effectiveness back then. Even today, low effectiveness. So what do? You have to rely on deterrence through the threat of retaliation. Ultimately, we did reach in fact, it's one of the few areas of great success in arms control, was eventually the U.S. and the Soviets, and then later Russia, eventually did agree to a limitation at first on nuclear weapons, and now we're living through a period where we're both reducing down to now we're about just under 2,000 nuclear weapons, down from the 25,000 in the Cold War. But that only happened when the USSR and the U.S. reached a certain parity of their arsenals, and cutting didn't advantage anybody. You know, you could cut in a way that everyone kept their relative positions. That's a hope, but notice how long it took. You know, nuclear weapons arrived in 1945, and the SALT agreements weren't until the 1970s, and the reduction treaties didn't start until the 2000s.
Once again, if you're in the audience, our lines are wide open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. I don't see any questions. Vince, if you have another question, I was going to ask about, does your argument sort of give away U.S. dominance? If there were a ban imposed on all these sort of new weapons, we're sort of left with the status quo, and that means American military might and dominance. Is that true?
I think that's right. If you could, suppose there were a way to have an actual outright ban, and then it left things the way they are with a focus on conventional weapons. I think you're right, Dean, that the United States still has by far the largest military in the world. It's really the only one that can project power globally at any point in the world for fairly quickly. The problem is we're highly dubious that such a treaty could be done and could come into effect at this time. But the second thing is, notice what you're also giving up. You're also giving up, as Vince was reading the conclusion of the book, you're giving up the possibility for a revolution in war that would make war less destructive and harmful. This is, I think, the unintended consequence of the existing laws of war regime. To the extent it discourages these uses of weapons, is actually trying to, it creates an incentive to use more destructive, more harmful, more primitive weapons, which would make war worse, not better. So again, a third point just to throw in very briefly, we do make a bit of a point of this in the book, is that this also is based on an assumption that the use of force should be reduced in the world, and that your main concern is military aggression or adventurism on the part of the West and the United States. We think that's just an assumption. It could be the case that we're actually starting to enter a period of greater instability where our alliances and the international system that the U.S. built is deteriorating. And it may be the case that as you see regional powers rise, autocracies challenging the system, like in Iran or Russia or China, or you're seeing great human rights disasters because of a collapse of the system or the deterioration of the system, it might be that the world would be better off if nations and the United States would be better off if we could use force more often, but in less harmful, more graduated, more precise ways to try to coerce the results we want without being stuck, as we are with North Korea, between doing nothing and letting this crazy guy have ICBM and thermonuclear weapons arsenal, or a full-blown conventional attack that would kill hundreds of thousands, if not millions of civilians in Seoul. These new weapons can provide options in between those two, I think, that tragic choice that a ban would prevent us from exploiting.
Well, Vince, this is Dean. I still don't see any questions from the audience. Push the star button and then the pound button on your phone if you have a question. We've got plenty of people on the line, but nobody with a question.
Yeah, I'll just moment ask a question. If there is a question, stop me. But the book
there is. We do have a question now, Vince.
All right, go with it.
This is Sean Callahan. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what constitutes a cyber attack. I jumped on the call a little late, so I'm sorry if you already covered this, but I can imagine a spectrum of action to include even engineering back doors into equipment that's delivered in peacetime to a nation that eventually becomes the target of a cyber attack. It seems like the demarcation between a cyber attack and a conventional attack, the demarcation with a cyber attack is maybe a bit more blurry than with the conventional attack.
Hey, Sean, that's a great question. We didn't cover it. We do discuss it in the book, but our point is that we should get away, actually, from this idea that there's a sharp demarcation between a formal war with an act of war that triggers it, and then just peacetime. I think that is the hope or the idea behind this kind of what we're talking about, this 1970s takeover of the laws of war in a very ideological fashion. There's a sort of noble hope behind it, which is, let's set the standard for war very high. If war is very terrible and destructive, nations won't go to war as often. Unfortunately, I don't think the practice and history has borne that out. I think actually you've seen a lot of wars since 1945, and you've seen a lot of casualties. A lot of these wars tend to be civil wars and internal wars with high civilian casualties. 90% of them are civilians. So instead, what we would say is, in the book, is there's a spectrum. I think this is suggested by your comment, Sean. There's a spectrum of coercion that other countries engage with each other because they try to pursue their interests, and sometimes that requires them to try to persuade other countries to change their policies. And so there can be lots of different ways to pressure other countries. And some of the ways we don't even think of as war, but they are about inflicting harm on other countries, like economic sanctions. And so something like cyber, we argue, should be considered in that same vein. The cyber can be used as a kind of use of force. It's not killing anybody. It's not destroying anything, but it's imposing economic harm. And we would say, in many ways, often less destructive and more targeted than the kind of economic sanctions that we've imposed on other countries, like on Iraq in the past, or Iran or North Korea, where the whole idea of economic sanctions is to impose economic pain on a population to get them to cause their leaders to change course. So we would say this sort of form of low-intensity cyber conflict that the U.S. and Russia and China, Iran, other countries are fighting right now, we would say don't think of that in terms of the peacetime versus war question, but just think of it as a point on a spectrum of countries trying to coerce each other. And so that doesn't mean – so I think we fall into this trap of the 1970s when we say, is a cyber attack on us an act of war, quote-unquote, and can we respond then with something that itself is an act of war? I think that falls into this effort to try to create this bright line between peacetime and war, which I think doesn't work. We're really not faithful to the customs and traditions of history and the way we've in other countries have fought war, but also – makes it harder for us to use these kinds of weapons like cyber in a way that could be less destructive and harmful for a war in the end.
John, in your book, you mentioned a phrase attributed to one of the drafters or analysts in the Geneva Convention in the 70s that I think applies to the question. So the supposed quote is that if we cannot abolish war, we can make it too complicated to fight. And I think that speaks to when you're trying to figure out what's an armed attack. The big thing is the cyber experts in Tallinn couldn't agree as to whether the taking down of a stock exchange would be an act of war or not.
Yes, and also to follow up on Vincent's, that's a great point. Follow up on Vincent's point also is that the United States just came out with a laws of war manual 2 years ago in 2015, and it's been worked on for many, many years. And in that, even the Defense Department, although it's saying it's a trying attempt to be a comprehensive examination of the way the United States is going to fight wars. But when it came to cyber and these new technologies, you remember that the Defense Department says, well, it might be possible to apply these rules to cyber, but we're not going to take any position and we're not binding ourselves to any course for the future. So even the Pentagon in the Obama years refused to take any clear view on whether cyber could be an act of war, as Vince says, whether attack on a stock exchange could be war. Also, Vince is referring to a group of experts, the Talon group, that tried to many of them former JAGs, but also scholars and former government officials that tried to come up with a manual or a handbook on cyber conflict. And to Jeremy and I, that is exactly what we ought not to do, is to try to come up with some kind of complete detail code that presumes to be able to figure out the law that should apply to all of these new situations before we have any experience or information about them.
Dean, we're in overtime now, so I guess we turn it over to you to close it out.
Yes, thank you so much, Vince Witkowski. I want to thank both Vince Witkowski and John Yu for joining us today. I also want to thank the audience for dialing in. And a reminder to the audience about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. We'll be talking about the Gill versus Whitford Supreme Court case being argued in the court in the first week. That's the political gerrymandering case. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.